Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up in this week's show, we continue our series of interviews with Louisville's Metro Council members.
When they go on TV or on the radio and say, this ordinance had a reading tonight and it's going to be voted on, well, they maybe don't have the education they need to understand how our process works.
Also, I'll speak with Larry Kane, an Emmy-winning journalist whose latest book chronicles his friendship with John Lennon.
She fell in love with him. Mm-hmm. And the subsequent relationship became the stuff of legends. And they kept in touch, really, till the day he died. So Yoko misstepped there and knew that and knows that now.
And WFPL Stephanie Sanders talks Derby with Steve Davidowitz, the author of the book, The Best and Worst of Thoroughbred Racing.
The Kentucky Derby, 20 horses. Riding in that race must be either sheer terror or the high wire act of the sport.
Now the news. Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll speak with journalist Larry Kane, who befriended John Lennon when the Beatles first arrived in the U.S. in 1964. His book, now out in paperback, documents his friendship with Lennon that continued up until Lennon's death in 1980. First, though, we continue our series of interviews with the members of Louisville's Metro Council. In previous weeks, we've brought you introductory information about the council and how it works, as well as interviews with the first few districts. Those are available on our website, wfpl.org. Today, we continue with three more interviews with the council members from districts 4, 5, and 6. Councilman David Tandy is an attorney by profession. He joined the Metro Council by winning a special election for the 4th district seat following the death of Councilman Willie Bright. WFPL Stephanie Sanders asked Tandy why he chose to run for that seat.
I've always believed that public service is one of the greatest gifts a person can give to their community, and to always strive to make things better for those that come after them than what it was when you found it. And so that's what inspired me to run for public office and to continue to serve in the capacity that I do. In my household, between my wife and myself, we are firm believers in public service and trying to give back to our community.
I kind of get the feeling about you that you're kind of a rising star. You're the young, fresh face in the council. Do you agree with that, and do you have higher political aspirations in your future?
Mm-hmm. I'm proud to serve the people of the 4th Metro Council District and want to do everything that I can to help make the 4th Metro Council District the very best that it can be. And likewise, I share a similar passion for all of Jefferson County. And so all I can focus on is trying to make the Jefferson County the best that it can be. And in the process, if other people see the work that I'm doing and they decide that, David, we want you to help serve us in another capacity, then we'll listen to them at that time and then have to consult the two higher powers that I always go to. First, have to pray about it, then I'll have to ask my wife what we should do. But until that time comes, if that time comes, I'm just proud to be a councilman on the Metro Council District.
How do you feel merger is working for Louisville?
I think merger is helping us become a first-class city that we all want. We are still working through our growing pains like any new entity would, and still trying to figure some things out, trying to find the best ways to provide services to as many people as we possibly can. But I think all in all, it has put us in a good position. We're trying to make sure that the promise of merger is something that is real and is enjoyed by everybody in our community, which was one of the concerns people had going into it. So I think we're on the right course of achieving our ultimate goal, but there's still more work that we have to do ahead of us.
Do you think that most Louisvillians know what Metro Council is and understand how it works?
Well, I think a lot of people are learning more about how Metro government is going to work and what we do here on the Metro Council. But I think you can also make the argument that to a in a broader sense that people in our community, or for that matter across the Commonwealth or across the country, don't really know what their local elected officials do, or for that matter their state representatives or state senators or on up the line into the federal government. And so I think it's more of a call for all of us to try to transform ourselves from just being residents of a community into becoming active citizens of the community.
District 5 Councilwoman Sherry Bryant-Hamilton has served on the Metro Council since its inception and previously served on the city's Board of Aldermen. Hamilton spoke with Stephanie Sanders about the challenges of creating a new council.
I think there have been some growing pains as we adjusted to this new form of government. But since we've gotten past the first 4 years, I think we're on a pretty equal and steady footing now. And everyone knows, everyone has shortened their learning curve, and we're all pretty much on the same page now.
Do you feel like, Louisvillians know what Metro Council is and know how they can be involved in Metro Council?
I think we're doing a better job now of getting that word out with Channel 25 and the opportunity for people to channel surf and get all kind of information and see our meetings and in progress 24 hours a day. I'm finding that a lot more people are actually watching and taking an interest in what government is doing.
For those people who maybe don't see the meetings on Metro TV and maybe only kind of perk up their interest when it comes around to those big issues like the animal ordinance or the smoking ban, things like that, do you think in the coverage of those big issues and big Metro Council meetings, do you think they get an accurate picture of Metro Council and how it works?
I think we do a pretty good job of trying to get the information out. A lot of times there's a lot of change of personnel in the media, and so we have to do a little education process so that when they go on TV or on the radio and say, this ordinance had a reading tonight and it's going to be voted on, well, they maybe don't have the education they need to understand how our process works. So then we get calls of people thinking, oh my gosh, is it getting ready to be voted on? It was like, no, it's got to go to committee. It's going to be discussed there. So a lot of times we go out to schools and to our neighborhood groups and try to bring the people up to speed on exactly how the Metro Council works. I think one of the things that people have had a problem with in not understanding is exactly what merger meant to them. A lot of people out in the suburban areas or in the unincorporated areas thought they were going to get the garbage collection and the street lights and the sidewalk that the Urban Service District enjoys. But without paying a little more taxes, those services are not going to be forthcoming and were not really actually part of the promise under merger.
I think in the cases in which people are paying attention to some of those bigger debates that the council has, it might seem that the council is extremely partisan and polarized. Would you agree with that?
It all depends on what the issue is. There have been times over the past 4 years where people have voted along party lines, 15-11, and there have been times when people have been swayed one way or another and have broken out of that mode. I think it's a good idea for people to examine the issue, what's important to their constituents, and to vote that way and according to their conscience.
Has there ever been a time, though, that you felt those party line votes have hindered the effectiveness of the council?
Definitely.
District 6 Councilman George Unsold is an educator by profession. He's represented his district since 1999. He previously served as an alderman and was elected to the first Metro Council. He spoke with WFPL Stephanie Sanders.
I was not a proponent of merger. it wasn't just the idea of merger, except that when the plan was coming out, there wasn't much ingredients to the plan. I just didn't see enough there. But that's what we have now. We got mergers, so we have to live with what we have. I see some change. And most of it's been good. Some of it's still up to chance, I guess.
So looking back on it now, you're kind of still have mixed feelings about it?
Still have mixed feelings about it, but I think since this is what we have, we have to make it work.
Do you feel like, because sometimes I get the impression with some of the bigger issues, some of the bigger stories that people take note of with Metro Council, that it might seem like the council is polarized. Do you agree with that?
Well, I don't think it's polarized, because you got 26 different individuals. I think it gets polarized sometimes depending on the areas in which we're working into or the areas which we're concentrating in. Whatever that subject matter is, sometimes polarizes.
But does it feel sometimes like it's too partisan? Does that make sense, that it's not so much about the issue as it is about Democrats versus Republicans?
Yeah, but I mean, politics, that's what we do. And we got two parties, two different philosophies, two ways of thinking. And there's some areas that you agree upon quickly, and others you may not ever agree upon.
Tell me about some of the things that you hope maybe in the next year Metro Council will deal with.
Well, I think the one thing that I hope is that we will come together on a major issue for the good of the city.
Like what?
Well, we're still dealing with arena. We're still dealing with some zoning issues. We got that doggone dog ordinance, you know, which is going to be, you know, we haven't seen the light of day on that yet. And so, you know, just some things that as issues come up, let us decide that this is good for the city and not yay or nay because of our political parties.
You seem, because I've been covering Metro Council for a couple of years, and there are some people who are very quick to make their opinions known and who talk a lot during the meetings, and it seems to me like whenever you speak, it's because you have a deep belief in what you're saying, and you usually wait to hear what a lot of people have to say, and you're kind of trying to say to everybody, wake up and listen to what you're saying, and let's be serious about this. Would you agree with that?
Oh, that's heavy.
Too much for you.
You know, I don't know if I'm all of that, but I've been taught as a youngster to information is power, and you can't get the information if you don't listen.
The full interviews with Council members David Tandy, Sherry Bryant-Hamilton, and George Unseld are available at our website, wfpl.org. Join us Monday, Wednesday, and Friday this week at 7:35 a.m. to hear from the representatives for Districts 7, 8, and 9. When we come back, I'll talk with the author of the book, Lenin Revealed. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. It was 40 years ago this June that the Beatles released this landmark album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And July 6th will mark the 50th anniversary of the first meeting of John Lennon and Paul McCartney in Liverpool, England. Larry Kane was a young radio reporter when he met the Fab Four shortly after their arrival in this country in 1964. He forged a friendship with John Lennon that continued up until Lennon's death in 1980. Kane went on to become an Emmy-winning TV journalist, most notably in Philadelphia, where he still lives. He wrote a book about his friendship with Lennon and about Lennon's personal life. It's called Lennon Revealed, which is now available in paperback. Kane spoke to us recently from his Philadelphia home. When did you first meet John Lennon?
Well, I was a 21-year-old news director at a station in Miami, and I luckily got on board the Beatles airplane and the Beatles tour by being very aggressive and sending a business card to Brian Epstein, their manager, and basically told him that I was going to represent my television, my radio station, and I wanted an interview in Jacksonville, which was the closest place they were coming. I was in Miami at the time. And he thought I was a big radio mogul, and he invited me. And he didn't know I was 21 years old. And I think when he saw me, he was kind of flipped out. Let me put it that way. I first met John in a very, very unusual circumstance in Miami, very briefly at a news conference. But I really met him on August 18th, 1964, at the Hilton Hotel in San Francisco. I had just arrived, and the Beatles were in the room down the hall. And the press secretary invited all the traveling press corps, which was about five of us, including two British reporters. I was the only American broadcast reporter who traveled the entire event in 64 and 65, to meet them. And I walked into the room with my 35-pound tape recorder. You know, technology didn't exist then.
That's right.
And it was heavy. I can still feel it. And reel to reel, by the way. And I met Paul McCartney, who was lovely, having a drink, and George Harrison in the corner, as usual, looking at his guitar. Ringo Starr, very, very joyful. And I went up to John Lennon, and he looked me from head to toe, and he said, "You look like a round peg in a square hole." And I said, "Oh, okay." And he said, made some remarks about the way I was dressed, because I always dressed kind of formally in those days. I only had one jacket. I think it was Robert Hall was the company. And he said, "What are you doing here?" And it was very nasty. And I began to ask him some questions about Vietnam, racial polarization, immigration policies in the United Kingdom, the upcoming election in the United States between Johnson and Goldwater, and all the excitement that was going on and the tragedy in the aftermath of the Kennedy assassination. And all of a sudden, he lit up. And I realized that the key to success with John Lennon or any of them was treating them as human beings, not asking them questions like what they ate for breakfast, if they had real hair, what they liked in a woman, the hemline, all that business. So I walked out the hall, and he, oh, and by the way, he said to me, he said, "You look horrible," and I said, "You look like a slob," and I walked out. And I figured, well, you know, I really messed up this one, and I walked down the hall back to my room. And all of a sudden, I felt two hands on my shoulder, and a person turned me around, gave me a big bear hug. It was John, and as you'll know from reading the book and other stories, John did not give bear hugs lightly. And he said, "I'm really sorry. I want to apologize. I enjoyed the interview. I look forward to traveling with you."
So were you embedded, as it were, with the
group? I was embedded for two summers, 1964 and 65. The word embedded was not in the
right, yeah.
The brand journalism vocabulary then. And I traveled to all these cities and 63 concerts and helped them. I was very, very honored in 65. They asked me to do the audio for a broadcast special called Beatles at Shea Stadium. And the rest is history. I had my career as an anchor in Philadelphia and as a journalist. I did not want to travel with them. I mean, when the station asked me to go, I said, "Are you crazy? Why would I want to travel with a band that will be a three-month phenomenon, and by the end of the year, nobody will even hear of them again?"
I once had a girl, or should I say, she once had me. Show me her room. Isn't it good? Norwegian wood.
That just shows you the perspective and vision for all the journalism students out there. The key to this is never turn down an assignment, no matter how big or how small. You just never know where you're going to be.
Yeah, it lasted a little longer than 3 months, didn't it?
Well, you know something that's interesting. When you are in history, when you're really there, you never know when you're in it what it's going to be.
Right.
Even the Beatles themselves had no idea, even as late as 1969-70 when they started to break up, that they would be the iconic superstars of music and culture and literature and photography and on and on for the 20th and 21st century. So they didn't know.
So you got to know Lynn a little better over the years?
I got to know him very well. We stayed in very close touch, a lot of interviews. He was a man, and I'll tell you the honest truth about him. This book, by the way, Lennon Revealed, does not cover over anything. And I was just with Yoko last week in a special interview I did for my television show here. And she said she felt it was one of the most honest books ever written. And I'll tell you why it was honest, because nothing was glossed over. This was a man who was a terrible father the first time around. And much like his father was to him and his mother was to him. And in 1975, he began a journey as the first public, not as many before him, stay-at-home dad in America. That was a very significant move culturally in this country. This was a man who was, without question, a domestic abuser, who by the late 70s became an ardent feminist and couldn't believe what he had done. This was a man who was one of the great peace activists with tremendous internal passion, no superficiality at all, in the world, who later on became one of the greatest supporters of police and firefighters and bulletproof vests and protection for public servants in America. This was a guy who, without question, was invested heavily in drugs and alcohol, which is a drug, and really the demons all exploded within him during the mid-70s. And by the end of the 1970s, he was pretty clean and understood how healthy he could become.
I'm just sitting here watching the wheels go round and round.
A man who loved many women, but really loved only three: his first wife, Cynthia, Yoko, and a woman named May Pang, who plays a very interesting role in this book. May was their secretary, and Yoko decided in the, I guess around 1973, to find a new love for John to refresh her marriage. And she fixed him up, or tried to fix him up, with their secretary. May Pang was a lovely, 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 and still is, woman with two late teenage children right now. And she did not fall in lust with him. She fell in love with him. Mm-hmm. And the subsequent relationship became the stuff of legends. And they kept in touch, really, till the day he died. So Yoko misstepped there and knew that and knows that now. And the triangle that goes on between, I know this sounds very eerie, but right now, both women, in their own ways, are fighting for his affections in public utterances and conversation, and it's quite a battle.
Now, he had different creative periods. It was the Beatles, then the Plastic Ono Band, the Primal Scream Therapy, and the Lost Weekend, so-called Lost Weekend.
The Lost Weekend was with May Pang.
Exactly.
And he was a guy who I think was filled with, it's amazing. People talk about what he did. I wonder what he could have done. He began his musical career almost at the age of 11 or 12 with a guitar and that was purchased for him. And he just tried to copy the American rockers. And then something came into his soul that was pretty amazing. He began to feel all the emotions and anger of his life, and he started putting them into song. And the one really, I think, incredible aspect of Lennon and McCartney's work is how well they touched on the soul and sensitivities of human being, whether it be love or hate or despair and frustration, and how well they knew people from their own beginnings. He had this very creative period from the age of about 15 to about 26 through the Beatle time and through his Quarrymen time in England. He met Paul McCartney 50 years this July at a church concert. And they forever became friends and partners. He brought Paul into the band. He had a tremendous flourish of inactivity from about 1969 to 68 to about 1970. And then he created this song that was so controversial that people in many sections of the country refused to play it. And there were actually disc jockeys who smashed them in public rallies. And the song was Imagine. And in its day, Imagine was not a hit. It never made number one. Hmm. And yet today it remains as one of the top five songs in the history of recorded music. Then he went through a very bad period. Ironically, he wrote one incredible album in that time, the Plastic Ono Band, which is really, when you think about it, the Plastic Ono is one of the most amazing albums ever produced if you listen carefully to the music. He then languished with some street groups, and he and Yoko produced some fairly bad music. And then he went through the Lost Weekend with May Pang, and in 1975, he came back to Yoko early in 74, got his citizenship, they had the baby, and he started creating again in late 1978-79. And the album he created that was his comeback album, known as Double Fantasy, at least his part of the album, is some of the most amazing and uplifting music he ever produced.
Close your eyes. Have no fear. The monster's gone. He's on the run and your daddy's here.
He found a certain level of contentment, it seems.
Yeah, he seemed happy. And, you know, you never know how happy he was because, like all of us, we're all a product of our own hard work and also our experiences, and he was still angry. I talked to him, I guess, 2-3 weeks before he died, and he was still on edge, wondering how people would accept his music.
Well, the book is called Lennon Revealed, now out in paperback. Larry Kane is the author. Larry, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
More information about Larry Kane and his book, Lennon Revealed, is available at our website, wfpl.org. You'll also find some information about Abbey Road on the River, the annual Beatles Festival held right here in Louisville over the Memorial Day weekend. When we come back, WFPL Stephanie Sanders talks with Steve Davidowitz, a man who's been involved in the horse racing industry in various capacities for the last 30 years. His latest book is The Best and Worst of Thoroughbred Racing. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. The Louisville area is abuzz with pre-Derby festivities. Floats are being prepared for the Pegasus Parade, event halls are being readied for the extravagant parties, and everyone is wondering, which horse will it be this year? Will there be another thoroughbred that can capture the hearts of Americans like Barbaro, Smarty Jones, or A Fleet Alex? Is there a chance another horse will rise to Triple Crown fame like Affirmed or Secretariat? In order to better appreciate this weekend's Derby, WFPL Stephanie Sanders sat down with Steve Davidowitz, the author of the book The Best and Worst of Thoroughbred Racing. He joined Stephanie in our studios to talk about the advent of the Kentucky Derby, how it changed the face of thoroughbred racing, and how it changes the hearts of Americans almost every year.
I want to start in the section that talks about ideas and issues, and then you list some important innovations in the thoroughbred racing industry. And I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about a section about the Kentucky Derby and the Triple Crown and why that was an innovation to thoroughbred racing.
Well, it was a spectacular change for racing. It was a highlight event. It put the spotlight on the sport on a national level. The World Series, the heavyweight championships, they would dominate the press throughout the country. There was some radio in action at the time. This is pre-TV. And the race had been in existence for a while, and it was copied essentially off of the English classics, the Derby, the English Derby. And it's interesting how they have Americanized their name for their race. Now, they no longer call it the English Derby. It's now the English Derby. But in any case, Colonel Matt Wynn was like the Barnum and Bailey of horse racing and of Churchill Downs. And he practically on his back lifted up the image of Churchill Downs and racing with the constant improvement of purse money and meaningfulness of the race. And with the breeding industry that was surrounding Churchill Downs in Kentucky here, it was a natural event for the sports biggest owners and breeders to gravitate to, and it became such an important fixture, as it is today even more so, for them to shoot at and to breed horses and to train them for. So without that, there wouldn't be racing as we know it today. So what else is an innovation than that?
I mean, do you think, though, that a lot of people, maybe not even racing enthusiasts, but maybe people who just tune into the Derby, you know, once a year, do you think maybe because this is horse racing as we know it, that they kind of take those innovations for granted?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the experienced horsemen and horse players do the same many times over. It's sort of like, did they take Jackie Robinson's breaking the color barrier in baseball for granted? Most of the younger black players coming along probably had to be schooled on what Jackie Robinson was with the recent event that was the 50-year anniversary of his appearance in the game. More than that, I think that actually it was the 60th anniversary. I think it was 1947 when he broke in. But the whole point is that it's such a wonderful tradition. And even if you have never seen a horse race, or if you're back in Oregon or Idaho and you're not going to really go to a racetrack very often, you'd be surprised how many people do wind up looking in the papers for future information about Kentucky. It happened to me. I was in an 11-year-old Little League player with my Leon's Photoshop uniform on, staring at the 5-inch Dumont TV when I saw Native Dancer get beat by Dark Star. It's in one of the chapters on greatest upsets, as a matter of fact. And it hooked me to an extent that even though I was a gaga about baseball and Mickey Mantle, I would turn the sport pages to look at some race results. And later in my life, not that many years later, it connected. You know, the dots were connected. I think out of the crowds that watch the Derby every year on TV or whatever, you'll get a small new percentage of people who will attach themselves to racing just because of the Derby.
And a lot of people, this is a great segue, because I wanted to talk a little bit about some of these crowd pleaser horses in your crowd pleaser section. But I think a lot of times people attach themselves to racing, but sometimes they just attach themselves to a specific horse because they like its story, or they like the way it looks, or they like its color, or they like its name, or something like that. And I wanted to talk a little bit when I was reading through this one, section, and it had just the most popular horses. It lists, you know, consistent horses and versatile horses and why. But when I was looking through the most popular horses and I got to number one, I could not help but my heart feel warmed that it was Barbaro. And I thought, well, that in itself, that my heart was warmed, shows, you know, what an effect Barbaro had on all of us. Is that even something that's explainable?
Yes. It seems like it shouldn't be because it's an emotional attachment, but it is explainable. Let's take a look at number two first, Secretariat.
Absolutely.
Secretariat was certainly number one until last year. Last year, with the explosion of media that we have, with the opportunity to live the pathos, the ups and downs of this wonderful racehorse who was so thrilling in the Kentucky Derby and then seemed so close to death right after the Preakness, and then to see the miraculous kind of treatment that he was getting. It didn't wind up the way our fairy tales like to be consummated, but, you know, in the end, he attracted more interest, more exposure worldwide than ever before, and that's only possible now in the modern age. If Secretariat came along in 2006 or 2007, it might be a heck of a horse race between the two of them, because he was a wonderful horse who made the front covers of three national magazines during the Watergate scandal. And people recognized, how brilliant and how wonderful a creature he was. People saw that in Barbaro. He won the Kentucky Derby so effortlessly, and that just heightened their ups. You were caught by it. My family was caught by it. Some of them haven't been to a race yet in their lives. I got asked about it. I forwarded email messages from the New Bolton Center to various friends to keep them updated on it.
Yeah, I mean, they got tons of cards in at Churchill Downs, mm-hmm. and had all these, collected money to send him treats and things like that for his stable. I mean, it was amazing to see the support come in from
that. Well, not only that, but there's a tie to his story that goes back to Ruffian, the great filly who also died on the racetrack in a match race in 1975. Ruffian was the best filly I ever saw, and most anyone else on this planet has ever seen, I would guess. And her trainer, Frank Whiteley Jr., is also profiled in some of his personality and thinking in the chapter on trainers, as she's profiled with respect to the fillies, the best fillies that I've ever seen. But she and Barbaro have an interesting link beyond their fate. And one is that Ruffian contributed to Barbaro's possibility of living. Because of when she was injured so severely, they took her to a facility off the racetrack and did a pretty similar operation on her that they did on Barbaro, and that they pieced her leg together, and she had a lot of damage, and people were heartsick over that. Trust me, and people still talk about that incident and her. At the same time, when she awoke from anesthesia, she thrashed about and undid all of the good work that the veterinarians and the surgeons had done. And that made them think it out a little better in terms of what they had to do, because the natural reaction, it seems, of a hyper racehorse who's coming out of surgery is to think they're still back in a race. Their legs go moving back in motion as if they're still in a race. And they developed this cast of rubber that they immersed the four legs of Barbaro inside, and then immersed him in water so that after the anesthesia wore off, when he started moving about his legs, he could do no damage, and the surgeon's work was still there. That never did Barbaro in. What did Barbaro in was the inability of a racehorse over a prolonged period of time to stand on equal legs like he has to stand, balanced, to prevent getting this disease called laminitis, which is the hoof pushing, bone pushing through the hoof and causing all kinds of pain and problems. And when that happens, if you can't repair that, and they did once, they stabilized the leg once, but when it came back again, it was almost hopeless from there.
And then even, as Ruffian helped to further veterinary medicine for thoroughbred horses, hopefully Barbaro has done the same for the next horse this happens to.
That's exactly their link. Barbaro did not die in vain in any stretch of the imagination, because I was at the New Bolton Center 20-some-odd years ago when a horse named Swale, who won the Kentucky Derby and the Belmont Stakes, died without seeming cause while he was jogging on the Belmont Park backstretch a week after he won the Belmont. They took him to the New Bolton Center to try and do, what happened, kind of autopsy. They never found out. And I was there for 2 weeks. And at that time, researching that story for a couple of newspapers. And at that time, they were 20 years ahead of their time. 20 years later or more, they were dealing with this horse, so I can only imagine the amount of expertise and technology and technique that they learned from this experience that will benefit so many more horses in the future.
And that reminds me of another section in the book. I didn't mark it, and I can't find it right now, but I remember reading in one of the lists about the problems with the frailty of the modern thoroughbred. I mean, what can, you know, to a lot of people when this keeps coming up so often with the horses that America falls in love with, and who knows how many other horses that are, you know, racing at Turfway and things like that that doesn't have the national spotlight on it. I mean, is this worth it?
Well, there's about four or five levels to that question that if you're trying to really be honorable about your answer and not just, you know, throw out some spin, are required. And I'll try and be brief about each of them. As a concerned horse player, and that's basically how I'll describe myself. I'm not a veterinarian. I'm not a horse owner. I bet the game. I've watched the game. I've reported on it. I love it. Okay, I am sure that no animal on the planet is better treated than the thoroughbred racehorse on a daily basis at every track in America, even at minor tracks where, you know, the feed bills are just as expensive, the veterinary care is not any cheaper, and the people are there with them 24 hours a day. I believe that, and I've seen that. Yet at the same time, there are abuses that have crept into the game just like they've crept into other sports. We have steroid Barry Bonds cracking through the home run barrier. We have many other players who have admitted or have been caught doing that. There are trainers and veterinarians who are involved in that type of activity. There's an internal fight against that. There are people in the media, like hopefully myself and a few others, who will occasionally write about some aspects of this. There are racing commissioners who are very disturbed about that. There has to be more done on that level. That's in one of the title of this book is The Best and Worst of Thoroughbred Racing. And that's some of the worst right there. And also the people who are working hard are some of the best. Now, you know, as far as the way the racing surfaces have contributed to this problem, there is a movement now with this poly track and cushion track, these artificial racing surfaces that are now in use in two tracks in Kentucky. And all of the tracks in California are going to have them by the end of the year. Some already do. Woodbine in Canada has one. Arlington Park is going to have one this summer. And they seem to be safer. The verdict is not 100% in, but they do seem to be safer, which, if true, if proves out that the way they're handled and maintained also makes a level playing field for the horse player. People should never forget the horse player in this equation. Without the horse player, there is no horse racing.
Right.
Not on the scale that we have. You'd have a steeplechase meets, you know,
right.
where once a year there might be, you know, 10,000 people that show up and not 130,000 at Churchill Downs. And the kind of racing industry, farm industry that the horse player helps to build and keep going. And in truth, it's a wonderful game. It's the best game that I've ever come across. And I've played chess, I've played bridge, and I've played on pretty good levels. Horse racing is amazing from the intellectual challenge that it presents. And it's only fair, it's only an intellectual challenge, only a fair game when the racing surface is not manipulated daily to do this or to do that, but is trying, and they try to keep it as a level playing field. Now, certain quirks show up on all tracks, and there's quirks that are showing up at Keeneland in the way that races are being run there. A track bias, a term that I coined in a handicapping book many years ago, shows up. Whether the bias shows up or not is not as important as whether it, once it's there, do they try to manipulate it to change it, the track. And they have to decide that they want a level playing field from the grandstand and the racetrack. So there is a movement to deal with that. So we have the drug issue, and there has to be some movement there. You have the racing surfaces. There is movement there. You have the way horses are being trained these days. They give them more time between starts. That's positive in many respects, but it also means smaller fields. So having a racing surface which is safer that'll bring horses back sooner is good. So this, as I said, is an issue that has multi-levels to it. It's not pleasant in anybody's eyes when you see a horse go down. But it is a dangerous sport. Yet, as I say, the horses are extremely well cared for. And almost every sport that I know of has injuries and, in some cases, fatalities. I admire the jockeys tremendously. I think they are often ridiculed unfairly. They are often blamed for the way races are run by disgruntled players, or people who don't know what it really takes to ride a horse tremendously under pressure in a field. The Kentucky Derby, 20 horses, riding in that race must be either sheer terror or the high wire act of the sport. Bill Shoemaker's ride in the 1986 Kentucky Derby, which also is an interesting story from the standpoint that he looked completely through, this great jockey. And this race that he ran and that he rode in that race was the single most impressive race ridden by anybody that I have ever seen. And he certainly has a lifetime record that would put him at or near the top of anybody's list.
And all that is in the book as well,
yes.
I think in a couple of sections. I wanted to talk a little bit about, as we talk about Derby favorites and how America usually warms to a certain horse. And we talked a little bit about Barbaro, but certainly with, in addition to Barbaro, I can remember in recent years of Smarty Jones, of Fleet Alex, people really warming to the story behind the horse as well as the horse. And there's a section about accomplished owners and trainers and kind of the histories behind there. And I actually grew up in Central Kentucky in Bourbon County. So I, did a little cheer when I saw Claiborne and Calumet on there. But talk a little bit about maybe some of the backstories that people don't, that are still important and are accomplished, but people maybe don't warm up to because it's not the Joe Schmo who pitched in with like six friends to buy a racehorse.
Well, I think every year you come to the Kentucky Derby, you can open up the Louisville Courier Journal, the Daily Racing Form, and even some newspapers around the country, and you'll see in-depth background stories on something unusual or some lifelong dream coming true. You don't even have to put a name on it in terms of, any specific horse or gentleman or woman involved. You had the, but you go to Bob and Beverly Lewis, the California couple that met at a racetrack, practically got married at a racetrack, and lived their rest of their lives at a racetrack, and got to the Kentucky Derby and won the Kentucky Derby, Silver Charm. One other horse that they had that won the Kentucky Derby. They almost won the Triple Crown by a nose they lost. They lived and breathed the sport, and they became people that the rest of the world tuned into. Frances Genter, when she wins the Kentucky Derby with Unbridled, and trainer Carl Nafsker, who has street sense in this year's Derby, leans over in the cameras and the microphones, you're going to win, Mrs. Genter. Mrs. Genter, you're going to win. That was her lifelong dream, and she was past the point where you could manufacture new dreams. She was only going to live another couple of years, and it was a struggle for her, to get around. And it was a very heartwarming story. There are lots of stories like that. And I think every year the Kentucky Derby produces them. If you went out to Charlestown Racetrack on a Thursday night and you were to focus on the fourth race, a $5,000 maiden claiming race, and examine the stories behind all of the people there, you'd find similar stories. People get into this game and into sport because they either love animals desperately, they love horse racing desperately, or some combination of the two. It isn't usually, although there are some, just throw money at it and then, watch their horsies run around the track once every 6 months or 6 weeks. They get involved. And when they win, they feel like they won the World Series. It's just an incredible pull that people have with the sport and with the horses.
That was something that I noticed because I've only lived in Louisville for a couple of years, but that was something I definitely noticed last year in the kind of build up to Derby was the, and I'm sure this doesn't happen elsewhere, but the kind of the build up, including TV reporters kind of roaming around to see what the big feature story was going to be this year about the trainers and the owners. It's like a hunt to see where the heartwarming story is going
to
be.
It's hard to get a scoop when 2,000 people are trying to cover the same race.
Exactly.
Steve Davidowitz will be signing copies of his book, The Best and Worst of Thoroughbred Racing, Wednesday afternoon from 3:30 until 5 at Borders at 4th Street Live. It takes place right before the post position draw for the Kentucky Derby field. More information is available at our website, wfpl.org. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about today's show, go to wfpl.org and click on Studio 619. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. Alice Thompson provides website direction. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.